Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Family Matters. I'm Jill Egeezy. And, of course, my co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence, is here with me. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jill. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today.
I am so happy to be here, and the guest today is amazing, so we're going to have a great show. I just wanted to reach out to everybody that's in the East and everybody that's had trouble from this horrible, horrible storm, superstorm that hit the East Coast, and so many of my colleagues and acquaintances with the Parental Alienation Awareness Organization USA have been affected by this, and we, our thoughts and prayers are with you, and if there's anything that we can do from here in Illinois, please let us know. Michelle, have you heard from anybody New York way or any of your friends out there?
I haven't, and I have really called. It just goes right into voicemail, so who knows? I mean, I know they're okay. I just don't know what kind of severe emotional, financial, every pressure you can think of they're under.
That's for sure. Well, we're lucky here today. We've got some nice, clear blue skies and a little chilly, but good here. I wanted to talk about just briefly, as I did last show, we have the conference in Lakeland, Florida on November 16th and 17th coming up. That is going to be with Attorney Brian Ludmer from Ontario, Canada. And, of course, he is an expert in parental alienation. And, Michelle, you and I have such a high regard for Brian, and I know he's going to do a terrific job, as he did for us in Chicago. And we have Dr. Mike Bone and Dr. Bob Evans, who are also going to be there. And then on Saturday, we have an advocacy training that is going. There's going to be a facilitator there to work with advocates to be more proactive in the parental alienation community. And so I'm excited about that. If you are interested in attending, please go to kidsneedbolt.org. That is Danica Joan Fields' organization in Florida that is handling the registration. She is the chapter manager for Parental Alienation Awareness Organization USA in Florida, and she's handling that down there and all of the details that are going along with it. She's doing a great job. We are going to have a webcast. So if you can't get to Lakeland, we can get you there in cyberspace. So please look at that website, kidsneedbolt.org, and sign up if you're interested. It's a very nominal fee, and there are CE and CLE credits available. So,
And also, we need to welcome some new listeners.
We do. We have just had an amazing increase in our listeners, and Ruthie DiTucci and John McCune, the owners of Syndicated News, are doing such a terrific job getting our name out there. We are everywhere. So we've got Mexico, we've got China, we've got India, we've got Ireland, we're in South America, and we have some outstanding shows on our network. So please tune in at syndicatednews.net and listen to all of the incredible information that we have to disseminate. It's amazing how we've grown in the last few years, and Michelle and I are so proud to be a part of the Syndicated News family. We wouldn't be anyplace else. So thank you to all of you for being such a great support system to Michelle and I. Michelle,
yes.
Do you want to get a word in edgewise for a moment?
I would say I would broadcast from another country.
You would. I know. We could go to Ireland, couldn't we?
I'm just saying.
Honor people, it'd be fun. Well, let's get to our guest because this is exciting. We have today with us Nick Balla, and Nick is from Ontario as well. He is an expert in the family law field. He began his academic career at Queen's Law in 1980 after graduating from Harvard, and he is a legal scholar with a focus on issues relating to children, families, and the justice system. He has written or co-authored 15 books and more than 130 articles and book chapters, and has acted as a legal consultant to numerous organizations and government departments. He's a frequent speaker, sought after across the country of Canada and the United States, and he's just an amazing guy all around. His new book, Children Who Resist Post-Separation and Parental Contact, is so exciting, and he's written that with Barbara Jo Fidler and Michael Saney, and we are so excited to, Michelle and I, both get our copies and be able to just use these as reference material for the work that we do. So welcome, Nick.
Oh, thank you. It's a privilege to be here with you.
And is Nick okay, or would you prefer Dr. Bala, or?
Nick is fine. Nick is fine.
I've got to ask you something. I've got this book, and I've given it a good skim, and I plan to read it cover to cover, actually. Well, not under oath. Not every word under oath, no. But how long did this take you? This is the most definitive, organized book on the topic that I've seen in a long time.
Well, thank you. And I think one of the things that has made it a really exciting but also challenging project is that I'm a law professor, Barbara is a psychologist, and Michael is a social worker. So the three of us have collaborated on this. As you can see from the book, it includes both a review of literature. We talked to over 30 experts in the field, interview them and incorporate their interviews, including Brian Ledmer, who you mentioned, and as well as our own analysis, both mental health literature, clinical practice, and law and legislation. So we've been working on it for over 3 years from start to finish, and we're certainly, the book has just come out. We're starting to get emails from people who are reading it and finding it, I think, very helpful. It's primarily aimed, I think, at a professional audience, but it's also, I think, going to be very useful for parents who are involved in the court process if they want a somewhat more in-depth look. There are other books that I think are written more directly for parents, but I think this book is going to be a useful book, and I'm sure it's going to be used in different kinds of professional contexts in the court.
Don't forget that alienated parents have to go to a deeper level in their understanding and their information and their knowledge than most parents have to in the divorce process. That's why this book is going to be valuable to them, because half the time they have to educate their own lawyers and they have to educate therapists. So they're more sophisticated than normally people would have to be.
I certainly agree with you that unfortunately, or the reality is that this is very much a developing area, and there are many professionals involved in these cases, including lawyers, mental health professionals, who are not familiar with even the most fundamental literature or concepts, and it is very important to educate those audiences so that they can work with their client populations. There are, I think, as you point out, many parents who can't afford to have lawyers or can't afford to involve mental health professionals who are representing themselves. And there are certainly cases in which parents are, in effect, having to educate their lawyers and therapists. Having said that, I think it's also important to recognize that some parents, I think, who are involved in alienation cases on one side or the other may themselves have limited understanding or perception, and in fact it's their distorted sense of reality that may be driving some of their conduct, and so I'm not sure that all parents are fully open to being educated about these kinds of issues, and in fact one could say parental alienation, domestic violence related issues are often caused by parents' lack of awareness even in the face of educational efforts.
Well, yes. That's well said.
Nick, I want you to emphasize or tell us, how important do you think the cross-collaboration of mental health and legal professionals are in this area? I mean, so often, the lawyers are on one side, the mental health professionals are on another. They have two different schools of thought. So by writing this book with Barbara and Michael and putting it all together, how important is that to the family court system?
I think it's incredibly important. On the one side, I think if lawyers and judges don't understand the psychological dynamics of these cases, they're missing really the whole point. And these are different from other kinds of more typical, if you want, divorce cases. So it's important to understand that context. And on the other hand, particularly as the cases become more severe, I think that the mental health professionals, therapists, assessors, evaluators cannot deal with the case alone. They need to involve the court system. Having the court system there to deal with the highest conflict cases, to set limits on parental behavior, to hopefully, in most cases, to push parents to behaving appropriately, to recognize the interests of their children. I think one of the functions of a good family court system, and in some places we do have that in North America, in many places we don't, but a good family court judge will in effect be a kind of educator of parents in the sense of saying, you have to focus on the interests of your children and understand the effects of your behavior on your children. And in that sense, I think, mental health professionals have to be aware of the value that judges can have and the value of the threat of a court order, whether that court order is if you are abusive, if you are physically abusive to your spouse, you are committing a crime and you may go to jail, or if you are denying the other parent contact or access rights to that child, you are harming your child, and that may result in a court order that will result in the removal of your child, or possibly, it can be contempt of court in some jurisdictions as well. So to recognize that there are consequences, but one of the things about the family justice system in general is that we correctly, I think, say for most people who are separating, a negotiated, mediated settlement is the best one. One that does not, that involves what we sometimes call alternative dispute resolution, collaborative family law, trying to help people work to restructure their relationship from one of spouse or partners to one of co-parents. That's where we want to go. But for some people, those who are in higher conflict cases, the courts often have a critical role, and people have to be moved out of a sort of a mediation kind of situation where one parent may be exploiting the situation or dominating the other or abusing the other emotionally or otherwise, and into a court setting where there can be real effective limits placed on parental behavior.
Let me ask you a direct question. And can you tell us, most of the people listening understand what parental alienation is, and without going into a full definition about that, can you make a distinction between that and a justifiable rejection or a child who just resists visits?
Well, I think that this is an incredibly important concept and also one that is very challenging for people to recognize that there are, and that's why we deliberately chose a somewhat neutral title to the book, Children Resisting Contact with Parents Post-Separation. When children resisting contact, when they're not visiting, sometimes that is because the child has been what we will call alienated, has been influenced by a parent, usually a custodial parent, but sometimes it's the access parent, the visitation parent, into rejecting the other parent and behaving in a way that is not based on the child's actual experience with that person, but rather is a reflection of the alienating parent's conscious or unconscious influence on the child. If you want, sometimes people use the word brainwashing. I mean, not too happy with that, but it does capture the idea as well. But there are also cases in which children have legitimate, important reasons for not wanting to see a parent, and in some cases it's because that parent has been physically or sexually abusive. In some cases, it's a little more complex because it may be that there are issues with a step family, a step parent who, may be a good person, but they're reacting badly towards that, and there can be tension that arises in that situation. And there are also cases in which, and I think many cases fit in this middle group, where there has been some alienation going on, and one of the real challenges for parents when there is genuine alienation is to respond in an appropriate and mature way and not overreact. And so sometimes the child is resistant, but rather responding maturely, and it takes a lot of energy and discipline and maturity to do that, the rejected parent overreacts and then feeds into a cycle of further rejection, and then the child may be reacting not only to the parent, to the first parent who's alienating, but also to the rejected parent who is feeding into that cycle.
Are you saying that a regular situation of more non-pathological rejection can be turned into an alienation situation by way, dependent upon how the rejected parent acts.
Well, yeah, I was actually thinking that, although that is true also, that a situation of, if you want, of milder alienation can become more severe because of the reaction of the rejected parent. In other words, the rejected parent may say, you know what, this isn't really about me, this is being the child is being influenced by an alienating parent. But instead of responding maturely, and when I say maturely, you know, reading about it, understanding the dynamic, and responding in a child-focused way and understanding the pressure that the child is under starts to make the child feel guilty and angry and so on, and it then feeds into that. But you're right that there can also be situations in which there were, and often, you know, one of the challenges is that we're talking about a spectrum of behavior. And so in many situations of separation, there is a feeling of anger, hostility, sense of betrayal between the spouses, and typically one spouse, but often both, will feel that they've been betrayed, and so on. And it takes a lot of maturity and judgment not to communicate that to the child, to say to the child, I was involved with that, you're the other parent. That relationship is over. I have my own reasons. We have our reasons for separating. But you should continue to love that person. I'm going to support you, knowing that that relationship with your other parent is going to go on for the rest of the child's life. Instead, even after the parents are dead, it will go on in the child's mind. So to recognize the child is going to have to live with both parents, try to support that relationship, that takes a lot of maturity. And sometimes parents' negative feelings do come out, and they start to engage in alienating behavior. Sometimes it's very mild. And indeed, one of the things to recognize is that often there is, if you want, alienating behavior. The ideal, what we're striving for educationally and otherwise, is to tell parents, you should be supporting the relationship with the other parent. It's not enough just to say, well, I'm not going to alienate, but to say, how is the child going to live with both of you? How is the child going to go back and forth? How are you going to arrange scheduling, extracurricular activities, clothing? How can I support you in that relationship? How can I support my child in that important relationship? And or if the child comes back and complains about the other parent, you know, if a child comes home and complains about their teacher, we don't say, well, you won't go to school anymore, I guess. You say, how can I help you deal with that difficult situation to make that a continuing constructive relationship? But instead, sometimes parents get into a vicious cycle saying, oh, well, you're having trouble with the other parent? Well, no wonder, I've had trouble with them too, and let's see if we can stop contact.
So what are some of the worst mistakes you think reacting parents make?
Well, I think that reacting parents not understanding where their child is coming from and making the child, and I would say there's a wide range of behaviors there. And so I think one has to obviously understand the dynamics of an individual case, but making the child feel guilty, putting the child into a loyalty conflict and say, you know, you have to come with me, you're rejecting me. In fact, one of the, and there are, again, a range of situations, but not putting the child, making the child feel they're going to be in a situation of conflict, and being honest with the child and say, you know, I recognize that maybe you feel caught between the two of us. We both love you, and in fact also trying to deal constructively with the other parent and say, do we need a facilitator to work between the two of us? Not that our child needs therapy, but we need to have a parenting coordinator, we need to have a counselor to help us have a more positive relationship. And certainly the majority of cases can and should be dealt with in a constructive way with a mental health professional, a counselor. In some cases, it could be a trusted person who is a trusted friend of the family, perhaps even someone, you know, a minister or otherwise. But the facilitator there, however, has to have training and understanding of the dynamics of this kind of situation and help both parents try to recognize what their role is in the situation. And so to come back, you know, if you're involved in the court process, certainly judges have to try to understand what's going on in both homes. And if we have a custody evaluation, the custody evaluators have to see what the child's relationship is with both parents and what the interactive effect is between both the child and both parents. And also, there are sibling effects. So sometimes one child will become alienated and then influence the other children.
Nick, I want to pick up a call in just a second, but just to talk a little bit more about what you're addressing now, you're only talking about this situation applying to parental alienation at the mild to moderate level, certainly not at the severe level where there is no contact or, you know, bordering on the no contact, right?
Oh, that's right. And so we're certainly talking about a spectrum of situations. We're talking about from the point of view of the court system making an initial assessment about why the child is rejecting the parent. So are there issues of family violence? Does the child have a legitimate, genuine fear? Are there issues of abuse? And then moving along and trying to assess the situation. One of the central messages, though, of our book is the need to take these cases seriously and have a faster response. One of the tragedies of some of these cases is that if there is an earlier response when the situation is less severe as it's developing, earlier intervention, as with many issues, is more likely to be effective than once the child has become truly entrenched. And, in some cases, a minority certainly, the child may be so entrenched in that behavior that effectively the child, the only option the court has is to change custody. That may not be appropriate in some cases, and the judge may have to say, realistically, I can't do anything about this situation. So earlier intervention is certainly going to be appropriate, and part of that is ensuring that judges are aware of and understand the need for a effective, timely response.
Okay, and we're trying to get that done in Illinois, aren't we, Michelle? We're working on that. I want to grab this call. I think this is Robert. Robert, is that you?
Yes. Hi.
Robert,
how are you doing?
Hi. Good. Do you have a call for Nick or a question for Nick?
Yeah. I'm just. I know Nick. You tend to see the. How can I put it? That it's a much more nuanced, the alienation process, similar to, I assume you're quoting a lot from Johnson and Kelly's model, that it's...
Yes. I think that there are, at the ends of spectrum, there are clear cases. So there are clear cases of severe alienation where we can say it's all one person's fault. And conversely, there are clear cases of domestic violence where we can say all one person's fault. But there's also a lot of cases that are in the middle. And so what I think, people have to be asking themselves is, as parents, am I in some way feeding into and contributing to this, or am I dealing with it in a constructive way, recognizing the position the child is in?
I agree, but, from a practical standpoint, you mentioned that that the courts need to deal with the mild cases seriously and forthrightly, because that's the best chance of any therapeutic intervention, corrective behavior. But if we start saying everything is so nuanced and the courts are reluctant to do anything because we promote this notion of a nuanced alienating behaviors, they're not going to do that. And it's going to, of course, escalate into much more serious levels of alienation for which, therapeutic intervention becomes much more difficult, if not impossible, which I think in your article you mentioned, in your 2010 article with Fidler. So you see why I'm so nervous when we start talking about this from a legal perspective, from a much more nuanced. The courts are not going to do anything,
If one doesn't understand the complexity of the situation, one's probably not going to have one will often have an inappropriate response. And so one of the things that we advocate very much is having case management. So having a judge who understands family dynamics, and in some places we do have experienced domestic relations judges, and in other places we don't, but having an effective, knowledgeable judge dealing with the case as quickly as possible. But if there is a genuine dispute about what is going on, I think that it's necessary to come to some determination about, in fact, it's essential to say, why is the child rejecting this parent? And often in the highest conflict cases, what you have is one party saying, well, there's alienation going on here, and the other party saying there's abuse going on here. And until you can make a determination about that, it's inappropriate to say, well, we're going to have a dramatic intervention here, including if one parent is saying, look, the reason my child doesn't want to see the other parent is because there's sexual abuse going on. I don't think you can say, well, just, you know, forget about the abuse allegation. Go and see your father, or there's going to be a contempt finding. You have to come to grips with what is going on. If there are serious allegations, hopefully if there is early intervention, and certainly in many cases where there is early intervention, you can get the parents to work together. And this is where one of the things is we need the legal system to work with the mental health system. We need the parents ultimately to work together. And so the legal system can push people back and say, you know, you're going down a track here that may be both very harmful to your children and very expensive. We'd like you to go and see this parenting educator.
I don't think you can get, when there is alienation, using your spectrum model, which is very important. You can't deal with the subject without it. I'm convinced of that. But if you think that you, a judge can get through to somebody who has proclivities moving up the spectrum, you can't get through to them. I mean, it's not a logical argument that you can make to them.
Well,
the reason I say this, and I don't know if my concerns are the same as Robert's, but my concerns are many judges will, and I'm guilty of it before I have been as educated as I have been from Jill and doing this program. Many judges will say, listen, this is no good, you shouldn't do this, and think they give them a wonderful speech and give them the best speech they've got, and it means nothing.
Absolutely. No, I agree with you, Michelle.
There's no doubt that some people, some alienating parents, are severely personality disordered, and no amount of talking will do anything about them. But this goes back, there is a spectrum, and so we don't want a sledgehammer to kill a fly. You have to say, what is the nature of this problem before you can have an appropriate response? Now, I agree that as you're going along, you're making an initial judgment if you're as a judge or a custody evaluator and saying, what does this look like and how is it developing? And one of the things to see is, if the judge has, you know, quote unquote, gives the best talk they have and say, okay, I've given these people a clear message, and to say, but I want you back here in 2 months and I want to hear what has happened in those 2 months. And if visitation is not going on, I'm going to, you know, have to review this and perhaps make a much more strenuous order. But maintaining that control, and one of the things is that with parents who are personality disordered, some of them, a significant number, if there's a clear message, they will respond to that. Conversely, if they're told, well, you know, nothing is going to, if the message they're getting from the court is nothing's going to happen, they tend to escalate their behavior. If the message is, I expect very clearly these things to happen, many people will respond to that.
I want you to know there, I don't think there's any fear that any of us has to have that the judges are going to react to kill a fly with a sledgehammer. Before that transfer of custody takes place, it has to be a really severe case.
Well, and I think you also have to take into consideration the other players in this. I mean, even if you have a parent who isn't that really sick parent that's hell-bent on alienating that child severely, you have a parent who walks in and may have an inkling of an idea on how to alienate a child, and they are fed then by their lawyer and GALs and the family court cottage industry that's been developed around this. And these are – they want to keep these people in the system because they see the monetary gain that they can get from it. So you have to take into account all the variables, not just the mental health of that parent that may or may not be an alienator.
I mean, I appreciate that not all lawyers are or mental health professionals are ethical, and there are undoubtedly some or competent who are exacerbating the situation. But I would say that it is often, unfortunately, one and sometimes both of the parents who are escalating the situation. I mean, I think it's easy to look back as a parent and say, you know, I was perfectly reasonable. The problem was the other parent, the lawyers, the judge, the mental health professionals, and they've ruined my life. And, you know, one of the questions I have is, well, so how did you get into this mess in the sense of, I mean, one, and it is a hard message for parents to hear, but how is it that you had a relationship for 10 years with this person and now they are so terrible? Like, how did that happen? It's not usual that, as we say, you know, Mother Teresa ends up married to Joseph Stalin.
Wow.
You know, you probably had something to do with how you got here, and you have to think back about that issue as well.
Well,
and
people don't
want to hear that. They want to hear it's the lawyers who are exploiting it, it's the judges who are incompetent, it's the mental health professionals who are unethical, and I have trouble with that.
What I'm saying is that they exacerbate the situation. And when you – I mean, I'm going to use my – I don't like talking about myself, but I'm going to use my own situation. I'm married for 21 years to a guy after I got married at 19 years old and you know, I had a volatile, horrible, toxic relationship for that 21 years. And it was the same after as it was during. And so – Am I blaming the 8 lawyers and the $1.2 million that was spent? Absolutely not. We had a joint custody agreement, but I was alienated from my children in 4 weeks and 6 days, all 4 of them. And we haven't seen them, my family and I, in 9 years. So am I blaming other people? No. I take full blame for anything that happened in that marriage and any hurt that I caused. But I think you're being really, calloused about it.
No, I think I'm being blunt I'm being blunt because I don't know what anything about your case, right? Like, I mean, and so this is you may well have exactly described it accurately, without knowing, you know, what happened, without taking a long look at it, who knows who is responsible? And that's the dilemma that judges in particular face. If someone says, this is alienation and I should be seeing my child right away, I've been a great parent, that may be true, but it may not be true, or it may be partially true. And that's a huge challenge for the justice system to say, well, what is really going on here? And you know, what is the role? And by the way, I don't disagree that therapists, lawyers, judges can make these situations worse, but typically they don't create them. It is something between one of the parents or both of them that has caused the situation. And then the question is, can the professionals who are going to be involved make it better, or will they make it worse? And so that's why they have to, among other things, I would say, understand the dynamics of the situation as best they can, and then start to respond to it. If you don't know what the dynamics are, you don't know what the solution is.
But, you know, it helps when you use the paradigm of offense to consequence. We could sit here all day and talk about blame, not blame, and get a measuring scale and try and figure it out. But for us as judges, we... in order to make some sort of evaluation about whether or not there's alienation, we have the at least one of the scales we look at is the consequence, for example, no contact, completely out of proportion to what the offense is. We do look at that paradigm. I'm wondering, you spend in your book some time talking about the concept of a child having a greater affinity or connection with one parent. I believe that's probably true. How does a parent not get reactive to this affinity?
Well,
what do you suggest?
Like
my child would have a greater affinity for his dad, for example.
I mean,
how do
I
look
at that's a great example. So in some cases, a child when they're younger will say they're living with mom primarily and seeing dad, and it's a boy, let's say, and he's getting older and he says, I like to play football and dad's the coach of a football team. I want to spend more time with dad. Now, the mom can say, I'm wondering if your dad's alienated. You can say, well, I can understand as you are growing older and your interests and needs are changing. And in fact, I think parents, all parents, but especially parents in situations of separation, have to recognize that any arrangement they make is going to be changing as children get older. And their inclination, their affinity to one parent is going to change over time. That's not to reject. And if a parent says, well, you want to spend more time with your dad, it sounds like you're rejecting me or there's alienation. That then makes it worse for the child. So to say, well, what's going on? Oh, you do play, I see you play football. I don't really know anything about football. I never watch it on TV. I can understand why you want to spend more time with your dad, and I'm going to help and support that. It's not a rejection of me. It's saying you want to spend more time with your dad under these circumstances. And it may change over time, and not making the child feel guilty. I did want to come back, and there's an analogy here. You mentioned Robert mentioned the work of Janet Johnson. There's an important analogy here to domestic violence, which is the opposite, or in some ways, an opposite side of this. There were people who came forward and said, look, domestic violence is one thing, and it's always an abusive man who is going after a woman, and we need to deal with this through the criminal justice system. There are clearly cases of very severe domestic violence in which a criminal justice response is necessary and appropriate, but there's also a spectrum of domestic violence, and there are some cases, for example, in which there are false allegations of domestic violence. And so if you're a judge and someone says, there's domestic violence here, send this man to jail and let him never have contact with a child, you have a responsibility as a judge to say, well, what's really going on here? And I have to make, as best I can, a determination about that factual issue before I decide what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. We've got some calls, Nick, so I'm going to grab these so we can hear from our callers. Hello, caller. How are you?
Do you have me?
Yes, Mick. Is that you?
Yeah, yes, it's Mick.
Do you have a call for Dr. or a question for Dr. Balla?
Well, a comment. I'm going to go question and sort of like back up a little bit here because, I think Dr. Balla, I won't say a little naive. I'm an attorney here. And the court system is a very adversarial system. And it's real simple for us always to place the blame on the parents. And personally, I don't think the blame is the parents. It's the adversarial system and the lawyers. And, yes, we do feed the fire. So I think it's just being a little naive when we start pointing the finger at the parents and say, well, they're the ones who got us here. And lots of times, because I've taken clients who have been, I'd say, a perfect divorce. But once we step in the courtroom with a couple lawyers, we turn a perfect divorce into a pretty lousy divorce.
So what's your question, Mick?
But my question,
Mick, where are you, by the way? Where are you, in Illinois there?
I'm in Chicago.
Yeah.
I try to address these issues, especially when we're talking parental alienation. How do I address it? I'll tell you honestly, I'm very unsuccessful in addressing it in the family court system. And we also have a criminal statute that has to do with visitation interference and trying to get a police to write up something on, visitation interference is near impossible. And I can tell you the Cook County State's Attorney has yet to prosecute anybody for unlawful visitation interference. So now I'm trying to look, can I go somewhere else? And doing a little research there, I know there's an article out by Sandy Bernardo out of, New Orleans, about potentially looking at parental alienation, addressing it in different courts, potentially as a tort.
Yeah, well, you raise a bunch of issues, and certainly you know, one point that you make that I completely agree with is that in some cases, in fact, in a majority of cases of separation, dealing with them outside the court system, negotiating, not going to an adversarial mode, using collaborative family law is going to be appropriate and helpful. I think there, you know, the criminal model, and I know that Illinois has that legislation, which is, my sense was, and of course I'm not there, that it is very hard to get the police involved in any jurisdiction in enforcing these orders. I think that the tort solution, and it is an interesting article, and I think certainly one that attorneys should be aware of. There are jurisdictions, for example, New York State, where they will suspend child support as a way of dealing with alienation. I think that financial penalties, if you're dealing with a more severe case, it takes so long. You know, you talk about delay in the family justice system. My understanding is it takes a long time to get to trial for a civil suit, or longer in most states, and certainly in Canada, to get to trial for a civil suit than it's going to take for a family case. And, you know, if you get the judgment, how are you actually going to meaningfully enforce it? Well, if the person's working and so on, you may be able to enforce it. But I think that a tort solution, while possible vindication, it really doesn't do much for the child, and is actually, I question whether it's actually going to affect the behavior of an alienating parent to know that there is that ongoing litigation going on. If the threat of losing custody of your child, or, you know, and of course in Illinois and other places, the criminal justice is part of it. Contempt orders are another part of it. But I'm sort of dubious about whether tort litigation is going to do much to affect people's behavior, particularly because, as the judge pointed out, often the people are themselves that are suffering from personality disorder that's affecting their judgment anyway.
Well, the positive I see about the civil system is, at some point, I can ask for attorney fees. There's nothing else that I can do, usually, to a person who's got a personality disorder in the family courts. I hate to say it. The judges will say, you know, sort of shrug their shoulders and say, what can I do? What do you want me to do? And nothing gets accomplished. At least I think in the civil system, the threat of attorney fees and money might be a motivating factor that doesn't exist in the family courts.
Thanks, Mick,
for your call.
Thanks, Mick. Dr. Bala answer.
So I think you raised Mick raised some very good points. You know, my understanding is that there have been, you know, and I'm aware of cases like the Wade case that you had there, where judges have reversed custody, and I think that is the, you know, to most parents who are involved in these situations, the biggest threat is the threat of losing their children. And so if the judge makes a very clear message saying, if your behavior doesn't change, and if this child does not see the other parent, the only real response I can have is changing custody. And it's a credible threat. That is the thing that is most likely to change people's behavior. And the second threat, I think, is it will be contempt of court, and you may go to jail. Saying you might owe money in, you know, 5 years or 10 years down the line is not likely to affect someone's behavior as much as an immediate threat of changing custody.
Okay, Nick, I'm going to take another call from the 559 area code. You're on the air. What's your name? Hello? Are you there, caller? Nope. Okay, we'll go to the next caller. And I think this might be Robert again. Robert, do you have another question?
I've read that article by Varnado, and it shouldn't necessarily be dismissed because it does provide, and some people have commented that it does provide an interesting new area. And she talks about that, you know, the family law civil court system is designed to fix the relationship between the child and the parent using civil contempt. And we know that civil contempt is not designed to punish, but only to coerce into compliance. So, tort becomes a revenue of a means to provide a deterrent function, because it does hit where it hurts in the pocketbook, and it does.
We're losing clarity on.
Yeah, we're losing you, Robert. So I'm going to let Dr. Bala answer that, and appreciate your call. Thanks. You want to comment on that, Nick?
I think that Mick and Robert certainly have a good point that there's no that one can contemplate tort action, and if you're a tort litigator, that's worth pursuing. But in jurisdictions where there are financial penalties, and there are a number of them, and in fact, in my own jurisdiction, Ontario, we do allow attorney's fees at the contempt stage and at the alien. So we have cases here in Ontario where an alienating parent has been ordered to pay $250,000 in legal fees, but it didn't have any deterrent effect on that person's behavior, and there are huge problems then about trying to enforce that. My sense is that the most effective deterrent to someone is the threat of losing their child, losing child custody very soon. The threat of losing money way down the line is, I think, it is an interesting empirical question, I suppose. To the extent that judges are going to start to make these orders, and I think that there is, at least in some jurisdictions, a basis for that kind of a tort claim, will it actually affect people's behavior?
Can you get funding to do that kind of study?
Well,
wouldn't that be amazing?
But it would be a very long-term study because it takes so long to get a tort judgment.
You spend some time in your book talking about the judges who talk to the children in these cases to make some distinction between justified rejection, a regular resistance of visitation, and parental alienation. And you say judges sometimes just try and get the facts from the children, and this is not a good idea, which I completely agree with. Let's say, because a lot of times I have the lawyers give me the scripted questions so that the children isn't cross-examined by a lawyer. What kind of questions do you think can be given to the children to make that determination about what's really going on?
Well, I think that there is certainly an important role for judges meeting with children in general, and including in alienation cases. My sense is, and perhaps I'm biased because I spend the time that I spend with judges, and I have spent quite a lot of time with judges both in the United States and in Canada, they're judges who are interested in family law issues and are fairly knowledgeable. I'm aware of the fact that many judges are not. But the judges that I'm speaking to, I think, have a pretty good understanding. And when they're meeting with the child, it becomes pretty obvious, usually fairly quickly, are they simply parroting what the parent has been telling them. So if the child has a sort of so-called black and white view, my father is absolutely terrible, I never want to see him, and you start asking the child, well, why is that? And the child doesn't really have a very good explanation for it. It's often because they are reflecting the views of an alienating parent. And so I think it's important to listen to children. My sense is that judges who know what they're doing in these cases are actually likely to get a sense of whether the child is being alienated, rather than just listening to to what the child is saying. So to me, in a custody case, the issue is not finding what the child's wishes are, but really finding what the child's motivation is.
So you'd ask motivational questions? Because we have a lot of lawyers who listen as well. What kind of questions did you think would be the good Sherlock Holmes questions?
I mean, I don't think they're good Sherlock Holmes questions. I think it's listening to the child and gaining an impression from the overall interview. And so if it's the – and I think it –
But that
before
assumes
a judge,
you're
before
assuming,
a judge,
you have a sophisticated judge.
Well, I think that certainly judicial education has a role in this, but and in some states – judges are having educational programs about how to interview children. I think, Ohio, for example, is a state that is a bit of a leader in this area. But when interviewing a child, I think, there's a process that one goes through in terms of having the child feel comfortable with the judge, understands what is going on, that if you want, the ground rules are set out. And sometimes, by the way, it's what the judge says to the child is more important than what the child says to the judge, in the sense of that she's saying to the child, I want to hear what you are thinking, how you're feeling about living or your relationship with each person. I think one thing is to avoid asking the child directly, so choose between your parents. In fact, I think that's a very inappropriate question. If there's a situation of alienation, the child is very likely to very quickly tell the judge exactly what he or she wants the judge to hear, which is often what the alienating parent wants the judge to hear. So they say, you make sure the judge hears this and this and this. But listening to how the child says that will often give a judge the sense of, so is this the child's own experience, or is the child just being influenced by the parent? And then the judge telling the child, I'm hearing what you're saying, but I want you to know that you are not responsible here. Your wishes are not determinative. I, the judge, am going to make this. You shouldn't feel guilty about what I decide, and you shouldn't feel responsible here. You're not the one who's responsible. I, the judge, am. That message sometimes can be very important and, I think, relieve children from some of the concerns about these about being caught in the middle between the parents.
Okay, we're going to take another call from the 661 area code. What's your name, caller? Caller, are you there?
Is that me?
Yes, it is you. What's your name?
Robert. It's Robert.
Another Robert. Hello, Robert. What's your question for Dr. Bala?
Dr. Bala, first of all, I want to tell you how amazing your work is and how much it's valued and how you've changed how family courts see what's going on with families. So thank you for that. If I can get back to the domestic violence issue that you started to speak about, I understand parental alienation as a dynamic of power and control over a child who would rather not do what he's being coerced, forced, or encouraged into doing. And that sounds to me a lot like domestic violence. And when Just on the face of it, the family courts are not very well prepared to deal with domestic violence, but the criminal courts are. I haven't seen cases transferred to the criminal courts from the family courts. And my question is, I think, twofold. One is, why doesn't that happen? And the second is, on the other side of this, the alienating parent often makes the allegation against the target parent that they are they claim to be what they're not, and that is violence. And those cases get transferred into the criminal courts very quickly, and custody arrangements are made without too much hesitation or time or even cost on the alienating parent's part. So can you address that issue in the work that you're doing? So there's two questions. Why doesn't it get moved from the family court? And once it's in the criminal court, how do those false allegations get addressed?
Thanks for your call. We'll have Dr. Bala answer. Thank you.
Well, those are great questions. I do want to just start by saying that there are analogies between domestic violence and alienation, and I have written and believe it. In fact, in the book we say that alienation is a form of emotional abuse, and in fact, depending on the child protection legislation, your jurisdiction, it is appropriate for child protection authorities to be involved. And indeed, the caller raised the question of allegations of violence and allegations of abuse. Often those are going to be investigated by child protection authorities, so they are often implicated in these cases. And one of the messages of our book is that child protection agencies have to be better equipped. They have to have the policies, the training to better deal with these cases and be prepared to respond in an appropriate way, including investigation of, are these allegations of violence true? I think that the criminal courts are not going to have the tools to deal with most of these cases of alienation in an appropriate way. When we think about what the criminal court does, we send in the police, they arrest people who are violating the law, and they may well go to jail. Is there a role for that in severe alienation cases? Yes, although I would see it going more through the contempt side of it than through the criminal process. When if the police are being called upon to enforce orders, as they are in the criminal context, it is often terrifying to children. It's not very helpful to the child to say, well, you know, you're not getting to see your dad, so we'll send down a police officer there on Friday night to come into your house with a gun and drag you off kicking and screaming. And police officers, you know, I think there was a, you know, the judge mentioned this earlier, police officers, most of them hate these cases. They didn't become police officers so that they could take kids who are kicking and screaming saying, I don't want to go and see my dad, off to see him. And by and large, using the legal system, the family justice system, to lever people into mental health services, to lever them into appropriate behavior, is likely to be the most effective way of dealing with these situations. But there is not a perfect solution for every case. I think we can do a lot better. We have to do a lot better. And I would also say we actually are doing better. And so a number of callers have mentioned the fact that, you know, there is a lot more understanding of alienation now than was the case 20 years ago. There was as much alienation going on 20 years ago as there is now. It was just completely, it wasn't understood. It was ignored, certainly in the academic literature, in the professional world. And now, thanks, I think, in part to the kind of work that you're doing, and that parent advocates are doing and that lawyers are doing, we do have a better understanding. We're doing a better job. Just as I should say, you know, we had domestic violence 50 years ago was ignored, and now we're doing a better job of understanding, responding to it. But domestic violence, like alienation, is a complex situation. Some cases should be dealt with in the criminal courts, but some of them not.
And I agree with you. We really are doing a better job, and the judiciary is really making an effort, and in many cases succeeding incredibly. Before we're over, I have a quick question, because I think this could be, you have a whole treatment plan protocol in your book. And I'm wondering, as judges and as lawyers and as litigants, when we send a family for treatment, before we let them go for 6 months to a treatment that doesn't work, should the judge and the lawyers review the protocol to make sure that it's what it's supposed to be?
Well, absolutely. And I should say that, you know, one of the things about treatment is, in my reading of the literature, and I'm, you know, relying on my colleagues as much as anything, if you don't see significant progress in 6 to 12 months or less, you're not going to see progress at all around the issue of alienation. And so is there a role for treatment? Yes, but you want to see results pretty quickly and bring that case back to court and ask yourself, and I think your question really raised this, is that what is the protocol? What are the qualifications of the person? Is this a therapist who's dealt with alienation? And, of course, you know, every therapist has to start their career somewhere, but if they're starting their career, are they appropriately supervised? Have they had clinical training in dealing with alienation specifically, as opposed to being a more general therapist? What are their qualifications to deal with this kind of case? That is, I think, a critical issue that people have to ask.
Well, but I think, Nick, the answer to that, though, is, and you know it, and Michelle knows it, and I know it, that there are a handful of people in the United States and Canada that do this sort of thing well. And to fish around and try to find somebody who's dabbled or had their toe in it is not even worth your time, because they can really do more damage than good.
I agree with you that there is a real lack of resources and training, but I think that there is, you know, again, growing understanding, and frankly, there's a big difference between rural areas and metropolitan areas. There are certainly people out there who are mental health professionals who are not qualified and are making some things worse. Just the comment was made that sometimes lawyers make things worse. A therapist, for example, for the child, can make things worse, but the right therapist can make things better. And so the question you're sure is asking, what are the qualifications and skills and track record of the person you're sending a case to? Certainly just sending the case to any mental health professional has the potential to be actually negative.
Right. So what are the qualifications? Do they have to be trained in family systems? What are they?
Well, I think certainly family systems, but you'd want, have they had specific training and experience in dealing with high conflict divorces, alienation, I mean, what are their specific experience about that? It's not, we don't have any certificate programs that deal specifically at this point with that. So what have they done? How familiar are they with the literature in this area? What kind of training programs? For example, you know, we have the AFCC does training around this kind of issue, has had training programs. Have they gone to a training program? Have they had supervised experience? Those are the kind of questions that people have to ask. It's not a question of just simply finding a certificate. And there are, in fact, a range of different kinds of therapeutic orientations that would allow someone to deal with this case, but they have to have the experience of dealing with high conflict families. And is there experience with adults or children? If we're talking about therapy, is it for the child? Is it for the parents? Is it for both the parents together? Those are the kind of questions that people have to be looking at.
Nick, we are out of time, and I am sorry for that because I think we could go on and on with you. It's been an interesting show, and I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be with Michelle and I here today and answer the questions of our callers. Michelle, do you want to say anything in closing?
No, I wanted to yes, I have a lot more questions. That's what I was to say in closing. So I so appreciate, you know, you bring up some really important things. For all the lawyers and all the litigants and all the people listening, we build on a weekly basis answers and protocols to use. So we certainly know that you had great value added today, and we really appreciate it.
And Nick, where is your book available? Children Who Resist Post-Separation Parental Contact, A Differential Approach for Legal and Mental Health Professionals, that you've written with Barbara and Michael. Where is this available?
Amazon.com. It's fine. It's okay. By Oxford University Press USA, but it's available through Amazon.com.
Okay, terrific. And Michelle and I are going to read it.
Good luck.
And
keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank
so
you
much.
So much for hearing me today.
You were great. We appreciate it. Thanks. And tune in next time. We'll see you on Family Matters.
Bye-bye, everybody.